produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, hair testing technology becoming more common but remains unreliable. While urine testing remains standard for employee drug screening, hair follicle analysis is also becoming commonplace in the workforce. For an expanding list of employers, from Fortune 500 companies to casinos to school systems and metropolitan police departments, hair follicle testing is becoming the standard drug testing method. However, the technology is not without its critics. Hair strand testing detects the presence of drug metabolites that have passively diffused from the bloodstream to the base of the hair follicle. Opponents of this troublesome technology rightly argue that the test is biased both by race. The test is more sensitive to minorities and people with darker colored hair and age. Gray hair uptakes fewer metabolites than normally colored hair. While studies have indicated that marijuana metabolites do not bind sufficiently to hair compared to other drugs such as cocaine, i.e., occasional pot use may go undetected on a hair test, recent research also indicates that exposure to high humidity will rapidly break down marijuana metabolite levels in the hair of heavier smokers, increasing the likelihood of a negative result. Despite these flaws, toxicology experts say the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA, has proposed new rules now under revision that may encourage the greater use of hair testing in the workforce. Dr. Bruce Goldberger, professor and director of toxicology at the University of Florida College of Medicine at Gainesville and the current president-elect of the Academy of Forensic Sciences, said the proposed rules will increase employers' confidence in hair follicle analysis and will likely move the federal government to rely on hair for its drug screening requirements. Nevertheless, even SAMHSA warns that hair follicle testing is less than ideal, admitting that both environmental contamination and hair color can significantly impact the accuracy of the test. Quote, "The role of hair color is a major concern," close quote, SAMHSA says, noting that, quote, "data show that higher concentrations of some drugs are found in dark hair when compared to blonde or red hair," close quote. Nevertheless, the agency concludes, quote, "Despite these suspected limitations, the department still proposes to go forward with incorporating this new technology as an alternative to urine for federal agencies," close quote, which engage in pre-employment and random testing. Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano states that numerous issues, from color bias to race bias, limit the widespread use of hair follicle testing technology in the workforce. Quote, "Hair follicle testing isn't replacing urinalysis anytime soon and is still very rare in the workplace, especially outside of law enforcement and the gaming industry. As saliva testing or oral screening becomes more accurate and sensitive, the use of hair testing will likely go almost entirely by the wayside," close quote. More information about drug testing technology is available on Normal's website at norml.org. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. Today on the Audio Stash, in our Patient Perspectives interview, we'll hear about the journey of one multiple sclerosis patient through diagnosis, traditional and alternative therapies, and now medicating with cannabis. Julie Falco is on the Illinois Normal Board of Directors and on the Board of Ideal Reform in Illinois as well. Julie often speaks in public on the issue of medical cannabis. Here on the Audio Stash and in many different forums across the country, the fact that cannabis helps the symptoms of MS is getting more and more attention. Montel Williams is probably the most high-profile MS patient using medical marijuana. But beyond the headlines and the straight medical facts are tens of thousands of Americans living with MS in their own personal way. MS has no known cure, and even the cause continues to be hotly debated. What is known is that MS patients who use medical cannabis report benefits to their condition, but also to their lives in general. Now, what does that really mean? When MS patients say things change, what changes? Julie Falco joins us today with a very personal interview to help us understand living with MS and how medical cannabis makes her life better. Julie, welcome to the Audio Stash today. Thank you very much again for having this discussion with us.
Thank you for having me.
Julie, let's talk about when you first discovered you have MS. Looking back, what were some of the first signs?
1986 was when I first noticed symptoms, and I was dragging my left leg, and that's when I first noticed symptoms, and then I didn't have anything after that kind of cleared up. I didn't have anything for 2 years. And the first time it happened, I was just walking to a Jewel Osco, and that's when I noticed that. I was home for spring break from college, and I was walking into the Jewel Osco, and I noticed my left leg was dragging. My toes were dragging on the parking lot. And I thought that was very odd. I didn't know what that was. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm just, you know, taking it easy, spring break, hanging out at home. My mother was getting remarried. And so it was just a lax time. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm just being lazy. And it continued, and it continued to be a problem. And I figured out it wasn't just being lazy. And I had gone to a chiropractor, and he did some tests on me at the time, and he really didn't want me to go back to school, but, you know, I had to get back to school. It didn't seem that much of a problem. I thought I'd figure it out later, and I actually had, I was playing in a band then, and I had some gigs that weekend, and I had to be back at school to play the gigs, and sure enough, went back to school, and at the time, I was doing some singing, and I was on stage, and I was in the middle of the last set, the second to last set, and I couldn't even finish. I had to have another backup singer finish out the set the rest of the show because I had to go sit down because my whole left side stiffened up. My legs stiffened up in place like this. It just locked there, and I couldn't move it. And my left arm was bent at the elbow in front of my chest, and it was like I couldn't even move my elbow or my arm. Everything stiffened up, spasmed, where I couldn't even move it, and I had to be carried off. After the show was over, I basically had to be carried to the hospital.
And after that, what led up to your diagnosis?
I went through the gamut of all these weird symptoms, and we went to different doctors because we didn't know if we should go back to a neurologist or, you know, we went to an ears, eyes, throat guy or... And they couldn't figure out. They thought, oh, you have Bell's palsy on your face, and, you know, didn't really think anything of it. So after going through another sequence of doctors and not getting a clear answer, I got I had an MRI done. Yeah, I'm rushed to St. Presbyterian, and sure enough, they said, you have MS. So that's when it began. And basically, the neurologist I had was completely not helpful and just said, okay, don't just go home, don't do anything, rest. There's nothing you can do. Don't even bother going to support group. This was the advice he gave me at the time. And promptly, I switched doctors to find the support, something, you know, you could grasp onto because you have a known MS, unknown disease. What causes it, how to cure it, completely mystery. So, go home and don't do anything about it, that didn't sit well with me.
So this is in 1988, before the publicity about MS, and in a world lacking the internet and ability to just sort of sit down and look up the MS Society, at least for some information. Once you did find a doctor you were comfortable with, what were your first steps?
I tried, my hand at going to support groups, but they just never worked out for me. And I did a lot of reading, and I did a lot of different, actually, holistic treatments, naturopathic. I tried acupuncture for a while. I tried reflexology. I tried massage therapy. It's very beneficial. Swimming. Numerous different alternative ways to attack this, because I didn't know what else to do. As the symptoms did progress and they changed over the years, they always seemed to center in the legs. But in the last 5 years, I'd say, it kind of has moved. I have like a constant numbness and tingling now in my left hand. And I had a bad exacerbation where I couldn't play guitar. I couldn't hold down the string. And so it's been really hard. It's been a really hard progression.
Julie, you mentioned alternative therapies, but what were some of the pharmaceuticals and clinical treatments your doctors tried?
Well, early on, Chris, when I had a few exacerbations here and there, there was a point that I couldn't even walk. I couldn't even get out of bed. And they put me on different steroids. There was one called ACTH, and I forget the long name. I always forget the long name, but ACTH was a steroid. I took it intravenously for 3 days. I did recover my mobility. I was able to walk again, but it left me just devastated with side effects. I got completely bloated, feet swollen. I had to give myself these injections in my thigh muscle, which is just horrific. I had a hard time doing that. And I broke out everywhere, just one thing after another with that. And prednisone was another medicine they tried me on. And most of them to me did not, outside of walking again with the ACTH, but having so many side effects, most of the medications never really helped. I tried baclofen. They gave me baclofen. That's like the number one drug to help with your spasticity. That's what they give to you first. And I had a home health nurse, actually, and she was administering that to me. And when she left for the day, I kept monitoring it because I was feeling I was having like heart palpitations. They're like just these skips in my heart, and I'm like, what is going on? I feel really just really dopey. And I took my pulse, and I was like at 46 beats a minute. And I thought, this is weird. Okay, I'm really feeling loopy trying to go to the bathroom. And I call the nurse, and I go, is this normal? Because I noticed this the last couple of days, and I don't think it's good. And she's like, no, that's too low. You better stay off of that. So I stopped taking that medication, and I moved to Xanaflex. That was another medication for spasticity, and I had to take that at night when I went to bed because it made me feel like I was drunk on alcohol. I had woken up one evening in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and I could barely make it. I have a hard time walking, number one, but this was like I was banging into walls because my head was so lightheaded and it was very uncomfortable. And I thought, this is dangerous. I don't think I'll be taking this anymore. So then going through the suggested medications, it was always trial and error, see what was going to affect me. And I knew that I was very sensitive to a lot of the chemicals, a lot of these pharmaceuticals, but I kept trying, and nothing ever seemed to really work. And then I was taking the Tylenol 3s with codeine in conjunction with a beta seron shot, an injection I had to give myself every few days. And this medication is supposedly, what they say, this is what it's working on, is to slow the progression of the disease. It doesn't cure. It doesn't make you feel better or anything, but it's supposed to slow the progression. So I always call it my blind faith drug, because every time I took it, I'd say 98% of the time I would wake up the next day. I would take it in the evening. I'd wake up the next day with an awful migraine. I'd have all the flu-like symptoms and just achy muscles, achy everything, on top of just EMS pain. And I would have all these symptoms the next day. And so that day usually would be the complete rest day, and I wouldn't do anything because I felt like just horrid from all these side effects. And I would take the Tylenol 3 with codeine to kind of offset those symptoms. But then I find out that the codeine is constipating, so then I'd have to look into to take something to counteract that. So all these medications, all these things to try to help me was making me worse. I was getting more depressed and more just dark cloud feeling over your head, where you're just way depressed. You don't know where you're headed. I'm trying as hard as I could to, you know, just keep doing what I'm doing, try to stay positive. But every time you turn around, it's like now you're losing strength and mobility in this hand, and then you've got, feels like you have a tight corset on around your midsection. What do you do now? What to take now that I'm not going to feel miserable? So I tried some antidepressants, and those were horrific. They gave me Elavil, which I was just horrified by when I went to sleep and had nightmares of actually killing people, chopping their heads off. And I decided, okay, I'm not taking this anymore because my waking hours aren't really that depressive anymore if I'm killing people in my dreams. It was just really upsetting. A lot of the other antidepressants, Zoloft, Prozac, all of those, my toes and fingers would curl from just the constricting. My pupils would dilate. And I sometimes felt like I couldn't take a swallow of water because the reaction was just so intense to my body. And Wellbutrin totally went in one day to my doctor. She prescribes this to me, gives me some samples to try. And I was, you know, just feeling pretty low at that point seeing her. And I weighed in, at, you know, got my weight, which was already a normal weight, maybe a little under. Went back about a week later, and I had dropped 7 more pounds. I'm like, okay, this doesn't seem too good either. Then I find out when I see one of those commercials that it's actually prescribed as an appetite suppressant for people. And I'm like, why am I taking this for MS? Or depression, it's not really helping. I don't have the weight, you know, issue to worry about. So that left me very drawn, very weakened from even losing that weight. So it's been this kind of trial and error over the years. And that's just maybe part of all the medications.
And Julie, when did you first try cannabis medicinally?
Medicinally, I would say it was probably the early 90s. And I would smoke it. As I did, of course, in college. That's when I first really started smoking it. But when I started smoking it medicinally, I did it because it was like amazing that it calmed Blake's spasticity down. It helped with the insomnia. It just helped me relax so I could get some sleep and just calm all the shakiness down. But I didn't do it consistently. I didn't do it all the time because I felt like it was aggravating headaches, because I was prone to getting headaches, migraines. I have very sensitive, you know, sinus cavity, and I think that was irritating it. So, you know, I just limited myself to just every once in a while, that kind of thing.
And how do you use cannabis medicinally now to alleviate the symptoms of MS?
I started baking it in a mix of brownies. And once I started eating it and having it go through my liver instead of my lungs, I was floored at the amount of benefit that I got from it. And also by being on it consistently, 3 or more times a day. But I average 3 times a day of eating a brownie. My brownies are about the size, they're like 1 inch square. They average 1 inch square. Kind of the size, maybe a little bigger than the size of like the caramels you get, you know, during the fall, little caramel squares, or like a die, you know, and have dice, the die, maybe, you know, a little bigger than that. Right now, I've been using just straight, like, cannabis. About 1/4 ounce is in a batch of brownies. I've used up where, because other strains, I've used up to, I've had 2 ounces in different strains that I've used in some of the mixes. And that's just the question of, you know, the different strains and how they work for what they're working on in my body and how they're affecting me. But the average brownie that I always taken, no matter what combination I've had in there, strain, was a 1-inch square piece. And in a brownie batch, we cut them up so that there are 80 squares. And, you know, about that size. And that actually cost $80. So this was our experiment, my experiment, to go, okay, that's $1 a brownie. The beta-serin injectable that I told you early about, that medication, that runs $1,000 a month. And it doesn't do nearly what this is doing for me, at least what I notice. And I don't have to pretend or imagine that it's having some effect. It was noticeable right from the beginning. I noticed how it calmed my bladder urgency down. Calms, you know, the problem with the constipation. It actually calmed even more so, more benefit than smoking it, for my leg spasticity and the insomnia. And I noticed in the beginning, like in the first year, that I was having profound mobility changes. As an experiment, I would go through periods like during the day, just really having a hard time walking. I would, when I'd get up, my legs, you know, flex and spasm so hard into a, like a straight-legged, stiff walk on my walker. And so it was always really hard to walk fluidly one step after another during the day. But there's a space in my apartment, it's about 20 feet, that I would walk in front of, you know, or walk through. This 20 feet back and forth. And one day I walked that 20 feet, I did 9 laps back and forth, 9 laps in 5 minutes when I was my stiffest and having the worst time walking. Later on, when the brownies would set in and I got more relaxed and everything, I was doing that same average 20, 22 laps in 5 minutes. I would do 22 as opposed to 9 laps, an average. And the highest I went was about 28 laps in 5 minutes. And that to me, and that was consistent. I did that for like a month, I think, pretty much that batch. And subsequent ones around that too. And I was having definite mobility changes that I think are profound, that I had friends and family over. And when it would settle in and I was standing up straighter, I wasn't so hunched over, you know, leaning on the walker as hard, struggling with balance. And all of a sudden I just had this, you know, I was standing up straight and tall, and my neighbors, my friends would go, you know, my family would be like, what's going on with you? You know, I don't know what's happening with you. And I said, well, that's the brownies working. Something's going on, that I'm able to stand up straighter and not be struggling to grab onto handholds, you know, walking around the apartment without my walker or the canes and, you know, using the furniture. But I was just standing up straighter, and that's a huge difference. I would say this past year, the hugest thing I've noticed that has changed has been, first and foremost, my mental attitude. I'm not depressed anymore. I have, you know, like anybody, the sad days, some trying days, some upsetting days, but nothing to where I was ready to commit suicide. which I was before. I am nowhere near that. I'm completely in a much better place mentally, too. And I know that has to do with the brownies I've been eating. There's nothing about it. And I've been doing it consistently so that it's like my body knows and is waiting for that medicine to come, because now it's accepting and ready to take it in and take care of what it needs to take care of. I truly believe that. After going through so many pharmaceuticals and really not getting any benefits, anything close to a benefit, maybe a glimmer, but having all the side effects just overpower everything else. And I have no side effects from this. There's no side effects. The only thing I've noticed is sometimes I get a little dry mouth. And to me, that's nothing. That's a drop in the bucket. No pun intended. It's you're going to be better for it by drinking more water. And that's the only side effect I've noticed.
Julie, I want to thank you so much for joining us again today. And I look forward to speaking with you in the future about Illinois Normal and your work there.
Oh, thank you, Chris. No, I appreciate it and love to tell you more.
Julie Falco is on the board of directors of Illinois Normal and also on the board of Illinois' Ideal Reform. We have links to both at normalaudiostash.com. Let's wrap up our Tuesday show today with some pod-safe music from podshow.com. Here's a group called The Joint Conspiracy.
Got to know exactly where the good vibes go, and then the way I feel, I don't need to know. So when I start to rise, see the sunlight in your eyes, and then the way I feel, I don't need to know. Turn to the city,
Conspiracy with PodSafe Music found up at podshow.com. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to podshow.com for all the great PodSafe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.